Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Rachel Smith, COO with ExchangeWire, and here in the studio with me, I've got our CEO, Kieran O'Kane. Kieran, hello.
Hello.
Yep, we've invited you back.
Behave. Thank you.
And our very special guest today is Liam Brennan from Mediacom. Hello, Liam. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me here. Good to meet you both.
Yeah, great.
Hello, Liam.
Hello.
So I wanted to kick off with the first news story this week, which is an article that CNBC released yesterday on Facebook's daily active user levels declining in Europe and plateauing in the US and North America. Obviously declining in Europe at a fairly, you know, modest pace, but nonetheless declining. And the article went on to mention that revenue is still up in both regions. But I guess my question to you two is, I'm interested in your opinion on what you think this sort of shift in daily active users means, whether it's sort of an inevitable plateau because, you know, it's been growing and growing and growing for such a long time. Are we at that stage now where it's just going to naturally plateau? Or the thing that I thought when I read it is this actually the start of some real behaviour change amongst users? Of course, we could, you know, extrapolate about how much it's connected to recent events or not, but it's just interesting that it feels like this is perhaps the first time in a long time we're seeing a different side of Facebook. Perhaps it's not the invincible, forever growing company that we all thought it was. So interested to hear what you think. Liam, let's go to you first.
Well, I'm going to jump in at some point and talk about Facebook, the platform, and Facebook, the company, because I think the two are very, very different. Mm. But we'll talk about Facebook, the platform, first. I think there's a really interesting post that Mark Zuckerberg put up on his Facebook wall the other day talking about the vision for Facebook in the future. And actually, he said that the Facebook growth is starting to stall. Mm. You know, pretty much everyone knows about Facebook, who wants to be on Facebook. So it's hit critical mass. And those who are on the platform, there hasn't been a raft of new features for a while on Facebook. So it's getting a little bit tired. It's still obviously massive. And when you're talking about a lot of markets, especially in the developing world, Facebook is the internet. So that's where a lot of revenue is coming from. But, you know, Facebook did very, very intelligently a few years ago. It's moved very heavily into mobile. And you see where the actual revenue figures are coming from. And it's all mobile. And it's predominantly coming through Instagram.
Yep.
I think 25% of revenue is forecast to be Instagram related by 2020. And so I think Zuckerberg knows that unless he does something with Facebook, the platform, he's going to have to diversify into Messenger, into WhatsApp, into Instagram to really keep those revenue figures up. Mm-hmm. You know, Facebook owns 4 of the top 5 apps on mobile. So really, when I see Facebook's base stalling, it's not really stalling, maybe going down a little bit. It's really the growth of those other platforms and the fact that they haven't really monetized Messenger and WhatsApp yet that I think is really exciting. I think that is where the focus is going to be for the future of Facebook.
Yeah. And you don't think, I mean, Kieran, you're going to have a view on this, but you don't think that any of the sort of decline in user numbers in Europe has got anything to do with GDPR?
So Facebook is fine. They have 2.5 billion users globally across all their apps. I think a couple of million people who've stopped using Facebook is hardly a crisis. I think Liam's right. There will be inevitably a shift in user consumption on other platforms. Other platforms will pop up. It's hard to kind of guard the Facebook platform, but it's a utility now. People use it for everyday stuff, like, so people use it in different ways, either to connect with their family or to use Messenger or to sort of organize invitations and parties and all the rest of it via the Facebook platform. But
said like a true Facebook user.
I am not a Facebook user. I got out of my Facebook habit 5 years ago, and I'm glad to say I have no Facebook apps on any of my phones, including WhatsApp. I use Telegram, by the way. So I don't know. European behavior, has GDPR? I think that there is a reckoning among some people around what Facebook do, right? The drip feed of bad press is starting to sort of permeate people's minds. And it's very, very, it takes a long time. But if you've looked at the press for the last 12, 24 months, it's nothing but negative stories, negative stories. Now, whereas Google seemed to have got off scot-free, even though they have as much access to where a person
pervasive data information,
but they seem to position themselves in a very easier way and not getting embroiled in all this, because they don't run that type of messy social UGC type thing. YouTube is obviously their Achilles heel, right? That is definitely their Achilles heel. But Facebook are basically a social company, right? Everything they do is social. So naturally, they're going to be embroiled in this. And I suppose they're sort of at the teenage phase now where they're growing up and they need to fix things fairly quickly, right? Mm. Which I think they will. I don't think anybody's going to abandon Facebook in any great... But there's definitely a growing consciousness around, particularly in Europeans who are much more savvy around their own data and I think encouraged by government legislation, that they will naturally move away from it and probably using the platform a little less. But from a buying perspective, from an agency perspective, Facebook is just so incredible. Like the grind they're targeting, the scalability, the ability to target specific segments. It's just phenomenal, and you can't look past that.
Would you agree with that, Liam, sort of coming from the agency perspective?
I mean, it's Google, then Facebook, and then there's a long gap until probably Amazon now is number three.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting is Facebook, to me, has always sat on really interesting data, and they haven't really activated on it yet because I think, back to the privacy concerns, I think if they did, that wouldn't bode well in their favour.
Mm.
And there's obviously some issues they need to sort out with, you know, privacy regulation, also measurement being a real concern for agencies right now. But they sit on information on consumers that Google doesn't sit on. It's like Google's very reactive.
Mm.
It's you're putting up a signal and saying, I want to do X, whereas Facebook knows you more as a person. Mm. And we've never really been able to tap into that data. Now, I don't know if we ever will. I don't know if Facebook will ever allow that to happen.
Yeah.
But there's some really useful stuff. And if you're talking about the evolution of targeting and how we reach consumers, Facebook will allow us to move away from segmentation and demographics into actual personality types, you know, what people are doing. And they've been, and actually it's kind of bit them before where they've, I think they were trying to prevent suicide, doing some sort of suicide awareness work. I think it was in Australia or New Zealand, and they're identifying people who are susceptible to putting up signals about killing themselves, giving them an alert. But actually that was enough to trigger a warning saying, how much do they know about us? Should we be afraid? And I think until they get over those privacy concerns, they'll never really tap into that ability to do that sort of targeting. So for me, it's an untapped potential, but I still think it's, you know, it's up to us as an industry to find out how to use them properly in my mind, because they are so massive. And again, they are the internet in many countries. That is the first place that people go and is the main use of phones.
And what do you make of, yes, Kieron is usefully pointing out the time to me, listeners, as though I'm not already aware of it. One final point on this topic before we move on to the next one. What do you make of Zuckerberg being summoned by a sort of a joint committee across the US and the UK to kind of answer to some, you know, government interrogation around how they're handling data and privacy? Yeah, I can see by the wry looks on both of your faces. That will go nowhere.
Waste of time.
Right, yeah.
All right, move on to the next subject.
So next topic is an article that was written in DigiDay last week about the slow adoption of ads.txt amongst media buyers. So the article goes into some detail about how publishers have widely adopted ads.txt, obviously as a way to show who's authorised to be selling their inventory in the hopes of preventing fraudulent activity and making things a little bit more transparent. Yet we hear that buyers aren't actually really flocking towards that inventory.
Mm.
And that begs the question, do buyers not care about buying fraudulent traffic? Do they not? Do they, you know, we talked in to some extent in detail last week about the BuzzFeed article on ad fraud and how prevalent it is and how pervasive it is. And this off the back of that just makes me wonder what is the perspective of ad buyers? Do they literally glaze over when sellers start talking about things like ads.txt and they just think, well, actually, I'm just going to be getting on with what I've been doing the whole time and worry about that later? Liam?
I mean, it boggles my mind that there are people that don't take this stuff seriously. And when I read stuff like that, I kind of go, why? You know, the biggest fear you have in an agency is the client sending you an email with their ads appearing next to something dodgy or them being caught into some sort of like ad scam. Now, thankfully, I've never had that happen to me, but I've been in agencies where that has happened. And then you get the questions asked you from someone very senior going, what did you do to make to stop that? And so GroupM, you know, which we're part of, has been very, very vigilant on brand safety, but also viewability. Appointing John Montgomery a few years ago to be the head of brand safety in the US. We've always taken it very seriously. When we talk to clients, we're like, you have to make this happen. But it always shocks me how often some clients are quite pushy on it. Now it's not so much of a conversation, but a couple of years ago, I remember trying to sell in technology like IAS and Double Verify to clients. They're like, oh, I have to pay for this. Will my CPM go up? And I don't think they realized how big a problem it was in the industry. for us, I mean, it's something we have to do now. Mm. And I think it's the responsibility of the media agencies to go forward and, you know, actually make this happen. And, you know, we have to clean up the supply chain. We're ultimately the ones responsible for buying that media. It has to be a priority for us. We have to make it happen. And if it's not happening, then I really struggle to understand why people don't do it. Yeah. I really do.
I have a theory about this. I think that if you're a brand advertiser and you don't use ads.txt, you're a fool. You may as well just take money out and burn it. Now, I do think that performance advertisers don't really care.
Yeah.
Right? And without fraud, we would have a situation where your CPA would be too high for performance advertising. I'll tell you why, right? If you think about, if you took all the fraud out of the system, right? All the bot traffic, CPMs would go way higher. Because people will realize that actually people are not going to all over the internet. They're going to five or six destinations a day. And I'm sure I'm like everyone else. You got five or six things.
Favorites,
you know, Irish newspapers,
yeah.
British newspapers.
Visiting every day.
Industry websites, email, you know, these type of things. And then obviously you've got your sort of like your news readers, which kind of give you news, right? So if you took all of that fraud out, all that bot traffic, not fraud, but bot traffic, prices would increase, right? Mm. Now, if you're an advertiser, right, a performance advertiser, you're looking to hit your CPA, right? And it's in your interest to buy cheap inventory. Now, if the entire market's flooded with bot traffic, it inevitably brings prices down. And I believe that bot traffic is essential from a buyer's perspective. Like, I'm not speaking for Lehman, but I'd say most agencies and a lot of performance advertisers do not like the situation as it is. Because if you can buy some fraud, you can tolerate that. But then within that, you've got cheap inventory that may sort of convert, right? So it's the irony of the situation. I do hear a lot of lip service going, why is 85% of all websites now in the US have ads.txt, right? That's ads.txt. Yet only a fraction of advertisers agencies are buying from those, right? And using that. So it suggests to me that it's a price.
There's
concept.
Another incentive for them to continue.
There's a procurement.
Now,
I am not saying that Group M or whoever are involved in that type of thing. That's not what I'm accusing of. But I'm saying there may be a knowledge or consciousness that this situation is helping to keep pricing artificially low.
I mean, there's this whole.
I mean, that's not me being conspiracy theory. I just feel.
Mm.
That there's something else at play, right?
It's 100% right. I mean, viewability and brand safety are obviously very different things, but we've been very pushy on 100% viewability, in view by humans. But a lot of other agencies and actually a lot of brands are fine with having less than that because they're like, well, actually, if I can get the CPM to half of what it is and my viewability is 70%, that works
That's
out economically,
good
right? But what we've seen is by taking a more vigilant approach, we're actually getting rid of some of those suppliers that are selling the crap inventory, all that bot traffic. And you're right. Usually when you see those big botnet scams emerge, agencies tend to sort of walk away scot-free because they're the ones that take the precautions because they're tending to be buying more, you know, branding type activity where you have to make sure that your ads are viewable and they're on the right sites that you're buying it from. But yeah, if you're buying a CPA, it's probably less important.
But would your clients, Liam, would they tolerate a 50, 60, 70% increase in CPMs? Because I genuinely believe that there's this opinion that traffic is infinite, right? Okay, Facebook, okay, scale, but it's like, inevitably, Facebook is dog shit inventory, right? It's contextually, about your mad uncle, your racist mad uncle, preaching, and there's an ad on the side. Mm. It's just not safe, right? But it's so cheap and so scalable. You're going to buy it all day and the segments are good, right? But outside of that, right, I find it incredible that all these video SSPs manage to find video when there is no fucking video on the web, right?
Mm,
outside of YouTube, right?
Yeah.
Like you barely see that many video, I mean, apart from Bloomberg and CNBC, which have broadcasting entities.
Yeah.
You never see video on The Guardian, very rarely.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So I find it incredible that this problem still persists. And I believe that is probably the reason, because I think the digital advertising space would fall apart if it wasn't for bot traffic. That's just my own opinion.
But I think, I mean, you're certainly right. I mean, the conversation has shifted. 2 years ago, going up to a market, especially in like some of the more developing markets where CPMs are, like, you know, before the open-ended programmatic work was done, you were buying off networks for $1, $2. An incremental jump of 10 cents CPM is quite a big jump. It's a 10% jump. And people are like, I don't want to pay that because my rates are going to go through the roof and I won't reach my reach targets. But now there's been more press about it, and actually people have seen some of these big networks, these bot networks, messing things up. People want to have that conversation. It's starting from a global conversation or a local conversation now. And I think that's the key difference. In the last year, some of those last clients who are a little bit resistant to it are all like, right, no, we need to clean up the supply chain now. Mm-hmm. I need to make it happen. Now, I'm not working with a huge amount of performance clients. They're mostly brand clients. So certainly good. When it comes to brand clients,
yeah,
you know, very restrictive. And you go through side by side yeah. and go, right, we've got YouTube on the plan. Is Facebook risky enough to add that reach? Yes. Then where do we go from there? And you keep adding and adding and adding.
Yeah.
And that's where the conversation's really heading now.
Right, well, interesting.
Liam's one of the good guys.
Liam's one of the good guys. And Kieran thinks digital advertising would fall apart without fraud. So
performance advertising would fall apart without fraud. Not brand. I think branding's fine. Yeah. I think performance is
important.
Yeah.
Right, moving on to the last news story that I wanted to chat with the two of you about today. Returning to a topic that we talked about briefly last week with Ellie Edwards, and we also touched on it briefly the week before with Amir Malik, in-housing. It feels like we spend a lot of time talking about in-housing. And the reason I'm returning to it is because eMarketer wrote an article this week about some research, and in fact one of ExchangeWire's research pieces that we did in conjunction with IPONWEB was named checked in this as well, that showed that brands mostly want to in-house in order to control and potentially reduce costs. And then actually some of that research astoundingly showed that they really didn't care about anything else. It was their primary motivator for wanting to bring their media buying capabilities in-house. Now, that in juxtaposition to what we discussed in the Mad Tech podcast last week, which was Vodafone reversing their decision to in-house media buying, and the general chit-chat within the industry about what does in-housing look like, who's in-housing, who isn't, what's the advantages, what are the disadvantages. It just feels like there's a lot of contradictions out there at the moment when it comes to what brands are getting up to with in-housing and what they really want to get out of it. So I'm really interested in your perspective on this, Liam, because I know you're interested. Tell me what you think.
What does the agency guy think about in-housing? I mean, the truth of the matter is some clients we work with have in-house their buying and some haven't, and some have a hybrid model.
We hear that a lot, right?
Exactly, and it is happening. And I think a couple of years ago, if you were standing around as an agency, you go, how dare they bring that in-house? They can't do it. Only we can do that. That's ridiculous. But what we're starting to see is actually some brands, it makes sense to have part of it bought in-house. Now, there might be a reason for that, to data access. They might have some very strong first-party data that can't be shared. Increasingly, sometimes we're seeing clients come to us and say, we'd like to dictate our own tech stack, but we want you to run it for us. I find it generally very difficult for clients, unless they are really, really large and running from a global hub, to do the whole thing in-house because it doesn't make a huge amount of economic sense. Because, you know, maybe you could run the US or a large market in-house, but then could you run Belgium out of Belgium? Probably not, unless you're spending quite a lot of money.
It's not going to be cost effective.
It's not going to be possible. So, you know, but we as an agency right now have had to evolve how we approach this conversation and be comfortable knowing and advising our clients on what's best for them.
Yeah.
Obviously, we'd love to run all the activity where we can, but the reality is that it makes sense, especially for performance clients particularly, to bring stuff in-house in the same way some people bought search in-house. I think where the conversation, I think, gets really interesting is actually, you know, we talk about things going in-house, but actually we're talking essentially about a method of buying moving in-house. So people talk about programmatic going in-house and actually talking like it's a channel. And actually it's a method of buying. And as we start to see more media, like above-the-line media, like out-of-home and TV, being built off the same data spine, you know, then it gets a bit tricky because, yes, you might have the same access to inventory, but how are you managing people on the client side, another market with a hub buying your above-the-line media in another market and agency, and it just doesn't work. And I think what you're seeing with the Vodafone conversation is probably they've clocked onto that a little bit and gone, actually, maybe it makes more sense for the agencies to be buying that work. I don't know the full ins and outs of why they've done what they've done. But that's certainly where it's going now is, you know, people that were buying in-house sometimes are taking it back to the agency, or at least taking it part of it back to the agency because they want to align all their media behind that same performance buying mentality.
Is there something in this about, because I mentioned it already, control, because that's where we got to last week, right? Was that there is a degree of, understandably, brands and advertisers wanting to have control over where their money is going. So is it about them accepting that some stuff just needs to be outsourced because and that they don't need to be in full control of some activity because it's not cost effective for them and because they've not got the skills and so forth. And then if that is, if they are focused on the notion of control and controlling costs, then is it that they're just interested in that specific relationship with their agency about where the money goes, and they want to see that as transparently as possible?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting conversation around actually the evolution of the agency and where it fits with the client. And obviously I had Amir on here the other week coming from a consultancy, and you know they're coming up to us and sometimes nudging us. But actually what agencies have to remember at the end of the day, we're advising our clients on where to best spend their money. And you know, that had turned into a conversation around control, and we had to control everything. But actually what's happening is now, as the agencies are being asked, like, what should we be doing, advise us on what we should do, which is very consultative in the way we operate, right? So these conversations about in-housing, out-housing, you know, there is a trust issue. I think the early days of programmatic, I remember the first time I encountered programmatic buying at another agency, it just became a byword for buying crappy media. And I think that reputation has stuck to some degree with some clients. A lot of trust has been lost. We've just taken on a new client recently. Can't say who they are, but you know, they have come in and they've dictated their own tech stack. They've worked with another performance buying agency to understand what were the best DSPs to use in each region. And we've been told we have to operate for that for them. And we can do that, and it is profitable for us to do so. But it comes from a place of mistrust of the agency that was managing before.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Kieran, what's your perspective on this?
I mean, this segues into our conversation with Liam anyway. So probably...
Yes, good point. And the timing is perfect. Yeah. Let's roll this on into
Q&A.
I
don't talk about in-house. It's very complicated. Let's put it that way. It's not as cut and dry as everybody thinks it is.
No, not at all. And, you know...
It's very nuanced.
Yeah.
That's a good word, nuanced.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's also, you know, this was another thing that we brought up last week as well. I think it's also not one of those functions that it's not like you're going to see an avalanche of brands just departing from their agencies and bringing everything in-house, because every brand has got completely different needs and dependent very much on the size of that, you know, of that brand and company and organization.
It kind of reflects the state of evolution around the agency model, which is kind of what we're talking about now. Because it seems that agencies are in a transition right now, that they've had to kind of reboot their model.
Yeah.
And you're obviously in the middle of that right now. So, I mean, how do you see that sort of fitting into this evolution? Like, so there's many, many things that are sort of occurring here, right? We have had digitization of the entire landscape, apart from TV, but that's coming. It's obvious it's coming. We've had this in-housing thing where the client's taking more control. We've had the rise of the DTC brands, which is quite interesting, particularly for you guys, because it's not a legacy brand and you've got to think things differently.
Yeah.
So how do you see, have you seen your agency, because your agency is obviously a new agency within the group, sort of move with those sort of changes?
Yeah, I mean, I'll talk a little bit about what I'm doing at Mediacom. So I'm working on a team called Blink.
Blink,
as in like blinking your eye, blinking, moving at speed.
Blink and you'll miss it.
Blink and you'll miss it, exactly. I'm a slow-moving person, though, sadly. But you know, we were born from the need to apply tech from a marketing perspective. And what we realized a couple of years ago, some people within Mediacom, is actually we were being asked more and more about tech-related matters, and not just ad tech, but actually, you know, what does technology mean for how we connect with consumers? How is technology changing how consumers behave? And how is technology changing how consumers shop? And there wasn't really a department or a solution that addressed that, you know. And more we were seeing other agencies or consultancies kind of moving in that space. And we're like, well, hang on a second. I think we need to have a response to this. We need to have some sort of POV. And that's where that team was born from. And what we've come in and done is said, like, all working with the clients at Mediacom, understanding what tech means for them and how it's changing how they operate. D2C, you mentioned, is a very good example. When you're working with CPG brands, the brands that are disrupting them aren't the competitors around them. They're these brands that are built from technology, new ways to distribute themselves, new ways to sell their products, new ways to communicate to consumers. So what we're coming in is saying, look, what we're going to try and give you is a direction where to go next. We're going to run some live experiments with a KPI framework around either a certain type of technology or a route to solve a problem or look at an opportunity and come back with some recommendations on what you should be doing and how you should scale it across your business. We've been doing it for 2 years. It's currently running out of London, but we're starting to roll out into other markets.
So is it more of a consultative thing?
An internal kind of consultative thing.
Clients come to you asking you what okay, I'll give you a good example. How do we approach the OTT space, right? Complicated space. Yeah. You know, you've got a couple of players in that. We've got many players in that space, but it's quite a bit of a Wild West scenario right now.
Yeah.
What's the best approach to that? Is that kind of the kind of thing we're talking about?
I mean, sometimes the brands will come to us with direct questions, but sometimes they actually just feel like we're not moving at the pace we should be. We're losing market share. Maybe we're not talking to the right audience in the right way. What do we do? So sometimes we can build a whole end-to-end innovation program. So I've been working very closely with Miles, for example, with the team running what's called Launchpad, which is the sort of end-to-end innovation program, running lots of pilots per year, focusing around consumer behavior, e-commerce, in-store retail, how we improve the ability to identify products on shelves, for example.
Is this there's a retail element to this as well, is there?
Yeah, so it's all comes back to marketing. Consumers at the heart of it, but it's going beyond media. And I think this is an interesting conversion point happening right now, I think, is the conversion between shopper and media.
Yeah. Mm.
So, and you look at Amazon, for example, right? And a lot of pitches that have come up this year have often involved the impact of Amazon and other e-commerce suppliers on some of the brands that we've been working with, because all the old models don't work in e-commerce. You know, if you're an impulsive product, you run a lot of television and digital video and you create your memory structures and whatnot. And when you're walking past your Tesco, there's some proximity advertising that pushes you in store. But when you're on Amazon, you're fighting the algorithm. You can't put a pop-up ad on Amazon. So what do? And so we're getting these big questions and it doesn't fit anywhere. So they are marketing related questions, but they're not solved by a banner ad or a video ad. So yes, it is consulting in a way, yes. But what we do very differently is we're not Bain or McKinsey or Accenture or Deloitte and coming back to you with a PowerPoint presentation. We're coming back to you with a recommendation based on live tests.
This is interesting. Okay. So you're talking to brands now who are including you in the conversation around actual sales, actual conversions. So Mars Bar might say, like, okay, we work with these wholesalers, right? But maybe the future of our sales strategy could be on Amazon or could be in Alibaba, right? Someone could buy like a 12 pack of Mars bars on Amazon and get delivered the next day. You know, has the sort of emergence of these new distribution channels changed the way you work with your brands and the way the brands think about stuff now? Because like this DTC stuff is not just a fad, it's actually real. Straight to the consumer. You know, you only have to look at the struggles and the travails of the high street middleman stores, right? They're not doing very well anymore. They're struggling to run profitable businesses just because the consumption habits of us around this table and everywhere around in the UK and Europe has changed so dramatically.
And permanently. You're right, it's not a fad.
It's not a fad.
This is the way that people are going to be buying and consuming from now on.
And in a world of digital, first party data is king.
Yeah.
And that's what gives the power to those DTC brands actually having a relationship between the consumer and the brand.
Yeah, I mean, the brands of the future are going to be digitally built brands.
Yeah.
And I've worked with a number of them, like Uber and Airbnb, and actually it's really interesting watching them come into an agency and looking at the model and going, this doesn't work for us because we're built very differently. They're built off often growth hacking models. All the early stage opportunities are not around long-term brand awareness, but how quickly can we grow this thing in like a year or two? I think what's really interesting about the D2C space is it's actually delivering on the promise of digital from like 15 years ago. And when I started working, I was working for a big bank that is in Australia. And what was great about digital back in those days, you could track all your credit card applications or your home loan applications, and you could actually put a value on the media you were running. But you couldn't do that until recently for CPG or maybe some degree telco or auto. But now more and more we can. And it's coming back to that whole, where does brand and performance collide? But also there are different pockets of client, like different parts of the business at the client side that we've never spoken to before that have become very important. And I remember working with a large video game company about 8 or 9 years ago that was doing a lot of work with Amazon, but wasn't speaking to their media team because they were too separate silos. But now you need the media budget to drive the shopper marketing sales on Amazon. Those two teams often don't talk to each other within a business, and now we have to be the connector.
Do you think that budget's shifting? Like, it's such an, like, we are in a really interesting phase.
It's fun.
This is the most interesting. Yeah. We've seen so many things collide, right? We've got the distribution piece, the programmatic piece, linear TV piece dying and moving into sort of addressable TV. All of the other channels becoming addressable. First party data, challenger brands, CPG brands being challenged by small brands.
It's a collision of
It's the most exciting time ever.
Pretty exciting things all at once.
And it's actually it plays into the hands of programmatic in many ways, yeah, because we've been using data for 10 years to automate and to optimize, and we're very data driven focused, so it lends itself to the rest of the ecosystems as well.
I think what's great about programmatic, gives you more control. And that's what I've always loved about it. And I think I was missold it originally. And I think it only took me a couple of years ago when I actually got to play around with it properly. I was like, right, actually, I know where my media is going.
Which app network was
this is actually
we're the performance part of another big media agency that I don't work at anymore. But you know,
was it a company called Rocket Mule by any chance?
Do not answer that, Liam.
I'm zipper-lipped on my NDAs. But you know, it's the whole thing of like the people that were buying the programmatic media, that you know, the practitioners are now becoming the planners. And people have to understand how these things work and what data exists and what we can do with it. I've been involved, and this is sort of a side track from the D2C conversation, but like I've been doing a lot of work on moving away from demographics as a way to target people into looking at moods and emotions. Because if you're looking at, like, let's say the CPG sector, actually, you know, you build your brand structures based on all your video, but actually it's those moments of impulse you have to start building. And unless you're walking past the store, you have to make those moments for people to buy those products. So you have to understand, when are people more likely to buy?
Smiley face. Yeah.
Exactly. When are they happy? When are they sad? And then that programmatic conversation becomes a strategy conversation. What data's out there? How can I activate on it? And so what you're seeing is, internally in an agency right now, is lots of disparate departments that were sitting in the back room or in the front room and now having to come together for the first time and talk in the same language. I love it. I think it's a brilliant time to be in media right now.
What about the agency model? Do you think that there's been a lot of negative press around the agencies? They've gotten such a beating in the press. It's incredible. I actually, who was fairly negative about agencies, now are coming to their aid on Twitter all the time, like going, oh, this is ridiculous, this is overblown. Yeah. I mean, where would this... It's interesting because we see this white space, this new service layer that needs to be filled. It's not just... It's a kind of a hybrid of consultancy and media planning, media execution. So it needs to be this new entity.
Yeah, and it maybe even hits on some of the things that you've said that you're working on, actually, Liam. It's that notion that you're not just consulting, you're providing some kind of live testing.
Yeah.
So it's something else, isn't it? It's not just, let's look at what you're doing and have a bit of a chat about what could work and put some proposals to you. Mm. Let's actually do something and show you what might work and experiment to see what won't work.
I mean, the agencies are different from consultancies, and obviously with consultancies emerging, they're sort of poking the finger at agencies a little bit, but like, we execute, they don't.
Yeah,
and I think that's one of the big differentiators. And I think agencies get a bad rap because for a long time they've sort of been stuck in their ways. They need to change. I don't think they need to go the full hog. I think, you know, things like TV, for example, are incredibly important. But it'll be those agencies that sort of dip their toes in the water, start to pivot, understand, A, how consumers are changing and how, you know, especially the younger consumers that are very different, but also how these new brands are emerging and how to work with them. Because if you look through the roster of most large media agencies, you don't often see those startup-y brands emerge on their roster. We've got Uber as one of our clients, for example.
But they will come to you eventually.
Yeah, eventually.
They will come to you.
They come to you when they need TV advertising or something
like that.
And that's
what
used to happen.
And
I have clients talking about growth hacking as a model for them, and it's not always right for an established brand, but maybe for a startup it is. And I think, you know, we are in a transitional period, and those agencies that are the merge the victors will be those that experiment and find a way that works, rather than kind of sticking their heels in the sand and waiting for the world to change.
Carrying
to
on,
them
as carrying usual. On as usual. Yeah. Amazing. We've run out of time, guys, so I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap it up there. But thank you very much, Ciarán.
Thank you. And I'd like to thank Liam.
No, I can't believe you just did that. I'm going to thank you too, Liam. And I'm also going to say first agency guests. So thanks very much for braving it. All you agency peeps out there, don't be scared.
We will have, but we are friends of the agencies, and we
very
are friends
so.
Of everybody. except the gaffer.
If I
Google,
do get
Facebook.
Fired for saying the wrong thing, you know, you can find me on LinkedIn.
Yeah, and you know, we might be able to rustle up a job for you here at Exchange Why, you never know. It's good to have another
fun,
Aussie
guys,
in the house.
Yes. Well, thanks guys, it's been a lot of fun.
Awesome. Thanks very much. Cheers. For listening. That was the Mad Tech Podcast.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.